And I guess hi to everyone who's watching the video. Today I'm going to talk about holographic entanglement entropy and some recent work I've been doing on it. And but let me just maybe, before I enter the talk itself, give some kind of broad brush motivation. Entanglement entropy, and specifically holographic entanglement entropy, is a subject that's been very exciting. A lot of developments going on over the last, basically since 2006, when the concept was invented. And there's a few different reasons for this excitement. One reason is that you have this quantity, entanglement entropy, which is something that you can study in the context of quantum field theories to learn a lot about the field theories and to learn a lot about the states of the field theory. So that's a very general, broad statement. It's, just as from correlation functions, from scattering amplitudes, from expectation values of non-local operators like Wilson loops. So there are all of these different quantities that tell you what's going on in a quantum field theory, and entanglement entropy is such a quantity. And the holographic formulas allow you to calculate it. So that's kind of a very practical reason to be interested in holographic entanglement entropy. Okay, you want to calculate a very interesting quantity, and you have a formula in the holographic context that allows you to calculate it. But there's another reason, which is these holographic entanglement entropy formulas, which I'll describe, have a bit of an aura of mystery to them. We don't somehow really understand what's going on, why they work, and they're telling us something new about holography. So they're pointing out to us, the fact that this formula arrives, basically deus ex machina, saying, here's, if you want to calculate this quantity, here's how you do it. You say, well, why is this the right way to do it? I don't know.
Wasn't it more or less derived by Malvasina and Rayford?
I'll talk about that. Yeah, I mean, the emphasis on more or less. But anyway, when it arrived, I'm just giving a historical thing. It wasn't clear why it was true. So it sort of points out the fact that we don't understand holography itself, which of course we already knew, but it sharpens it. And so basically you have these two directions you can go. You can learn about entanglement entropy from holography. You can learn about holography from entanglement entropy. Okay, so these are the two themes here. In particular, today's talk will emphasize constraints from causality. So on the one hand, it will be a new test of the holographic entanglement entropy formula. And on the other hand, the way that the formula passes this test, I think, reveals something new about holography. Okay. And I should say that Rob told me there would be a sort of a broad audience, including people from condensed matter to gravity. And so in that spirit, and I guess maybe in the spirit of Perimeter Institute, I'll try to make this a broadly accessible talk, and I'll try to review as I go along the necessary concepts and not assume that people are familiar with holographic entanglement entropy formulas and so on. But that said, I mean, it's quite likely that there'll be things I'll sort of forget to say along the way, so please feel free to interrupt. And if that means that I don't get to the last section of my talk, that's fine. Okay. This is ongoing joint work with Veronica Hubini, Albion Lawrence, and Mukun Rangamani. And here's the outline. Causality and entanglement entropy in quantum field theory,
quick review of holographic entanglement entropy formulas. Then the issue of whether or not it obeys the causality constraint. And then I'll present a GR theorem, which addresses this question. And then if there's time, which there probably won't be, I'll talk about an implication of this theorem for our understanding of, or a potential interpretation using this theorem. Okay. All right. So let's just start from the beginning here. So I've thrown out a lot of buzzwords. So I have some quantum field theory propagating on some Lorentzian space-time, which I'm going to assume is globally hyperbolic. So we have some Cauchy slice. Maybe I'll... So this is some Cauchy slice. And I'm going to assume that the QFT is in some state. So I'll call this Cauchy slice little sigma. And I'll call the state on the Cauchy slice rho sub sigma. So I'm going to, it's just convenient to sort of work in a Schrodinger picture where if I picked a different Cauchy slice and I just consider unitary time evolution in the space-time, then I would have a state rho sub sigma prime that would be related to rho sub sigma by conjugation by some unitary operator. And this rho sub sigma, it could be a pure state, it could be the vacuum, it could be a mixed state like a thermal state or what have you. I'm not particular about which state. If I divide my space, my Cauchy slice, if I separate it into a region and its complement, then the Hilbert space, I'm going to assume, factorize. This is a bit of a fiction in truth, but it's good enough for what I'll be saying today. Okay, so more precisely, it's an approximation, but for my purposes, it's fine, okay? That the Hilbert space for a quantum field theory decomposes as a tensor product according to spatial regions. And therefore, we can consider the reduced state or reduced density matrix, which is defined on the region A, which is operator on the Hilbert space H sub A, which is the trace on the complement part of rho sigma. And if you just consider the expectation value of some observables that are living entirely in A, then it's good enough to know rho sub A in order to calculate their expectation values. So for an observer who, for some reason, only has access to A, their state is rho sub A. And then we, from that, we get the entanglement entropy, which is denoted S of A, and it's just the entropy of this thing. And the point is that if this had been pure, but there was entanglement, in general, there'll be entanglement. For example, the ground state is always highly entangled spatially, and so this reduced state will be mixed, and so you'll get a large S of A. Okay, so we're interested in this quantity. Why isn't it? If you consider something like a gauge theory, then you have the Gauss law constraint, which actually says that the physical Hilbert space is not just the tensor product. Yeah, so there's subtleties like that. Basically, there's subtleties of what happens right on the this is called the entangling surface, D sub A, D of A, right? Yeah, it's actually this statement is false for any field theory, it turns out, when you actually study it from sort of an axiomatic point of view, but gauge theory is kind of the clearest case where you can see that it's not true. But the issues basically are all ones that are localized on the entangling surface, and we can neglect them for our purposes. So I'm not going to even attempt to motivate why we are interested in this quantity. It's incredibly useful in, I guess I'm going to try very briefly to motivate it. I'll just assert that it's incredibly useful in fields ranging from condensed matter physics to gauge theories and string theory, quantum gravity, and so on. So it has tons of applications, and we're always interested in knowing what it is, studying its properties, and so on. Okay. What I want to focus on is the causality constraints, because actually we're in some Lorentzian structure and we have some causal structure. And what implications does that have? So the first thing I want to point out is that if I change my sigma, and here I'm going to collapse a dimension just to make it a little bit clearer. So this is my sigma, and this is my a complement. If I change to a sigma prime, which is the same everywhere but on A, so this is sigma prime, then my rho is only changed by conjugating by a unitary operator where that unitary operator acts on this part of the Hilbert space. So rho sub A is also, so I have rho sub A prime is some unitary operator, rho sub A U inverse, and so S of A prime is the same, okay? Similarly, if I change sigma by something that is only different outside of A, so I have some other thing, so this sigma double prime, then actually it changes rho sub sigma by unitary operator that acts only on this Hilbert space, and therefore it doesn't actually change rho sub A at all, and therefore doesn't change S of A. So rho sub A is unchanged in sigma double prime, and so S of A is also unchanged in sigma double prime. So what we learn is that actually S of A doesn't really depend on the choice of A so much as on the causal domain of A. So I have this freedom to choose any Cauchy slice which is the agrees, which serves as a Cauchy slice for the domain of dependence of A. Okay, so given A, and let me redraw this. Given A, I can decompose my spacetime into four regions. So first of all, I have the causal domain of A. Which is the set of points such that every causal curve through that point goes through A. So since this is a Cauchy slice, for any point in the spacetime, any causal curve through that point goes through sigma. So the question is, does it go through A or A complement? If they all go through A, then it's in the causal domain of A. If they all go through A complement, then it's in the causal domain of A complement. If some of them go through A and some through A complement, then some of them go through the boundary. And so it's either in the causal future or the causal past of the boundary. So J plus of dA or J minus of dA. So dA is my entangling surface. Sorry. So in fact, so this argument implies that S of A actually depends not on A, but on its domain of dependence. Okay. There's another causal restriction on whether you can change S of A by perturbing the theory. So I want to ask the following question. If I fix the state at, let's say, minus infinity, t equals minus infinity, and propagate and evolve to the future, but now I perturb my Hamiltonian locally, does it change the value of S of A? Okay? Well, I mean, it's kind of obvious that if my perturbation is to the future of sigma, then, of course, I don't change rho sub sigma, and therefore I can't possibly change S of A. But furthermore, I can strengthen that by pushing sigma as far to the past as I want, as long as I keep D of A fixed. So I can consider, instead of this sigma, some sigma prime, which goes very close to the past. By the way, these boundaries here are called the Cauchy horizons. So I have my past Cauchy horizons, my future Cauchy horizons, and I can consider a sigma prime which goes arbitrarily close to the past Cauchy horizon. And obviously then I still can't change, since by this rule I haven't changed S of A when I do that, and since any point to the future of this new sigma prime, a perturbation there cannot change S of A, clearly any point in D of A complement or D of A perturbation cannot change S of A. Okay, so. So in evolution toward the future, a local perturbation in D of A or D of A complement, or obviously J plus of DA, so these three regions, can't change S of A. And then I can time reverse the argument and consider evolution toward the past, fixing the state at t equals plus infinity. And I get the same thing, except here it's D of A, D of A complement, and J minus of DA. Okay, I mean, the J plus and J minus parts of the statement I think are fairly trivial. The interesting point is that perturbations in D of A or D of A complement, whether you're going to the future or the past, cannot affect S of A. So, which another way to say that is that if you do a perturbation inside D of A, you know, it changes the time evolution inside D of A, but only inside D of A, and therefore it does not change the amount of entanglement between A and A complement. To do that, your perturbation has to influence basically the entangling surface, has to reach the entangling surface. Okay, so that's the statement. Okay. So what I want to do is to take this causality restriction and ask about its implications in the holographic context. So before that, I have to give some introduction to holographic entanglement entropy. So let me first say, a change in the Hamiltonian density. I'm still always considering a unitary evolution, but now with a slightly different Hamiltonian.
So if at some point you change the Hamiltonian, this is not unitary.
No, the evolution is still unitary, just it has a different Hamiltonian from whatever Hamiltonian I had been considering before. I'm always considering Hamiltonian unitary evolution by some Hamiltonian, just I have a new Hamiltonian, which is different from the old one, by some local perturbation. I add some local Hermitian operator to the Hamiltonian.
But always in the full region, not at some point, you evolve with a different Hamiltonian in D of A, not in some.
The evolution is, you know, of course, in the whole space time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, any other questions?
But I don't know what the meaning of this statement is. This is just a property of the state, right? The entanglement entropy, I have some state.
Yeah.
And I compute it. Now you are telling me about some Hamiltonian that will evolve it, I shouldn't care. I mean, it's just a property of the state. What?
Well, it's a property of the state on a Cauchy space. Yeah.
So that's why, this is why I wanted to work in the Schrodinger picture.
Okay, so I'm actually, my state is evolving with time. So from one Cauchy slice to another, the state is now related by unitary transformation. So when I talk about the entanglement entropy depending on the state, I start with a state on a given Cauchy slice that my region A is a part of. So that's why I didn't want to work in the Heisenberg picture where there's just a state, period, and the operators evolve. Although, of course, one can translate all these statements into that language.
Is it clear?
It's only me that doesn't understand, it should go on. But I don't understand what the last sentence there means. But maybe it's not crucial for the argument.
It's pretty crucial to the whole rest of the talk. The whole rest of the talk is going to be about these statements. Okay, so let me...
Evolving from where? I start with the state and I compute the end entropy. Now what do I do?
Yeah, so...
I evolve.
Start with a state at t equals minus infinity and some Hamiltonian. Okay, which could be time dependent. I don't care if it's time dependent or not. Okay? And you evolve it, you get a rho sub sigma, and you calculate your entanglement entropy. Now do it again, but with a slightly different Hamiltonian, where I've added a local perturbation to the Hamiltonian at this point. Do it again, you get a different state, rho sub sigma, because I've changed my unitary evolution that interpolates from t equals minus infinity to sigma. Therefore, I have a new rho sub sigma, and in principle, a new rho sub A, and in principle, a new S of A. Is it the same or is it not the same? Now, my perturbation, the question is, has it changed the amount of entanglement between A and A complement? Okay? If the effect of the perturbation can propagate to both A and A complement, then it can affect the amount of entanglement between them. If it only propagates to A, then it's essentially doing a local operation on A, which does not change the amount of entanglement. If it only propagates to A complement, again, same thing, okay? Any other questions? Okay, so we have this quantity, you know, which I asserted is important and very interesting to study. In fact, for example, there was an interesting condensed matter talk this morning about something that had absolutely nothing to do with holography, but where entanglement entropies were computed as a tool to study topological phases and so on. So one is very interested in general in computing these, and so a very important fact about them, aside from the fact that they're interesting to compute, is that they're very, very hard to compute in general. We do not have, in general, good tools for computing them. I mean, you can do numerical simulations of your quantum field theory. That's one way to go. But if you want to compute it analytically, you always have to make some approximations, work in some limit, and so on. So let me just give one example to illustrate the difficulty of analytically computing entanglement entropy. So recently, with some collaborators, so this is a paper that came out in last year. We calculated the entanglement entropy for a disk. So it was in a 2+1 dimensional theory. In 2+1 dimensional free Maxwell theory. That's it, just a gauge theory, free U1 gauge theory, no matter, no Chern-Simons term, the simplest thing, one of the simplest field theories there is, okay? So it was a very hard computation, actually, complicated, and at the end we had to do some numerics, okay? We did not succeed in finding an analytic expression for this, and the region A was just a circular disk. So we have every symmetry we could hope to have, okay? And it's just very, very hard, actually, in practice to compute these things.
And in fact, the tools we have to do it in general are not just complicated, but kind of awkward and indirect. And very hard to kind of see what they involve intermediate steps where a lot of very important properties of the entanglement entropy are temporarily obscured. And so it's actually remarkable that in the holographic context, we have a very beautiful formula for computing entanglement entropies. So the holographic context is also itself a limit and an approximation. So we have a QFT which will, in general, be strongly coupled. And have a large, be in some kind of large end limit. So a large number, some large number of degrees of freedom. And you might think that, you know, this is like the worst possible situation for computing anything, which it usually would be. And the magic of holography is that it makes a lot of things very practical to compute. Scattering amplitudes, Wilson loop correlation functions, thermodynamic phase transitions, and tons of other stuff. So obviously that's a huge industry. And one of those things is entanglement entropy. So I want to just describe the formulas we use to do that. So there are two of them. And I'm always going to be working in the limit, sort of where n goes to infinity and where the coupling goes to infinity, because that's where the holographic description becomes the simplest. So the two formulas. So first of all, we have Ryu and Takenagi's original formula, where the state is static. And so in that case, and sigma is a constant time slice. Okay, so here's the picture. You have some space time where your theory lives. And if you've ever been to a talk, even a single talk on holography, you've seen this picture. People always draw this. Okay, so the boundary is where the QFT lives, is the space time where the QFT lives. This is my time direction. And then I have some bulk. Asymptotically anti-de Sitter space-time, which is a solution to the Einstein equation. Okay, so these two limits imply that my bulk space-time is described by classical Einstein gravity. Okay, so specifically, the large n is what makes it classical, and the strongly coupled is what makes it Einstein, as opposed to Einstein, as opposed to having higher derivative corrections to the Einstein equation. Okay, and one can definitely ask about what happens when you sort of move away from this limit and so on. What are the corrections? But I'm not going to do that in this talk. So we have this asymptotically ADS spacetime, which is a solution to the Einstein equation with negative cosmological constant. And it's assumed to be static. And so since it's assumed to be static, so I have my Cauchy slice sigma, which I can extend into a Cauchy slice sigma for the bulk. So now I'm just going to do a picture where I forget about the time direction. So I just, this is that constant time slice. This is sigma. Little sigma is the boundary. And I pick some region A, and I want to compute S of A. And so I do it by finding the minimal surface. I should really be using my color since I asked for it. So let me use color. Call that minimal surface M. So M is minimal surface in the bulk. And M has to actually also satisfy topological condition. So it has to end on the entangling surface, which in this cartoon is just these two points. The entangling surface is the boundary of A. But it also has to satisfy a certain topological condition, which is that there has to exist a region A, I'm sorry, a region R, which interpolates between M and A. So here my region R would be this. Okay? In this case that I've drawn, it kind of doesn't impose much of a restriction, but if the bulk itself has non-trivial topology or the boundary has non-trivial topology, then it actually imposes a restriction on which M's you can consider. Okay? And then the formula is that my entanglement entropy is 1 over 4 times the bulk Newton's constant times the area of M. Okay, so that's the formula. And obviously it's very natural and beautiful geometrical formula. Okay, and also very useful. So it was first written down just as a sort of a proposal, and since then it's been tested in multiple ways. How should I work the boards here? I guess I'm supposed to do this. So it's very important to ask why we should believe this formula, whether we should believe it. And I'm just going to summarize a ton of work that's been done. First of all, there are many cases where you can, by working quite a bit harder, actually do a first principles calculation of the entanglement entropy. So there's quite a long list of such things. So it gives predictions which agree with first principles calculations. And in fact, there's recently a general argument, this one that Pedro mentioned, that this should work in general. Another reason is that it obeys an infinite list of properties of entanglement entropy. So it actually obeys, for example, strong subadditivity. And actually, all other known properties, known general properties of entanglement entropy. This is pretty remarkable, including ones that were only discovered, you know, in the last few years. And another thing that's remarkable about it is that the proofs of these properties using this conjectured formula are really simple compared to the real proofs in the general quantum information context. Okay? So actually, if you want to know more about this, my last paper is basically a summary of all of the known properties that it obeys. And so what it's saying actually is that somehow general relativity has read the quantum information theory textbook, knows all of this, you know, fairly sophisticated quantum information theory. Yeah.
So the entanglement entropy has the leading curve, which proportional area or log of area, something like that. So maybe, as I understand, maybe the leading term satisfies all these properties. My question is that there are many, many sub-leading terms.
Mm.
Well, the sub-leading term can also satisfy these properties.
Sub-leading in the size?
For example, in size, yes.
Yeah, no, this is all exact in the size. We are not doing any approximation in the size. Okay, so everything I'm saying is exact in the size. Of course, we are doing some approximation, but that approximation is in 1 over the coupling and 1 over n. So there are corrections, two kinds of corrections from here. Okay, but you can have any size and shape. And so you mentioned that there's the leading term is in an expansion in 1 over the size is from the area. And I could have mentioned this, and this is kind of the very first check you might want to do, since it's actually an ultraviolet divergent quantity. And I mean, I didn't say it, but this is an ultraviolet divergent quantity. It needs to be regulated and renormalized and so on. And indeed, that matches, that divergence in this picture comes from the fact that this is a hyperbolic spacetime. So it's the distance from any point to the boundary is infinite. And so the area of M is infinite due to the part of it that reaches all the way to the horizon. And you can match the coefficient, and you can match, you can work pretty hard and match the subleading ones also. And then you can worry about the most interesting test, of course, is not the divergent part itself, but the universal subleading parts, like coefficients of logs and so on, and you can match those. And in fact, in some cases, the formulas for those were discovered first by applying Ryutaki and getting a prediction and then seeing it. Okay. Okay, and then the third thing which I just want to mention is that aside from the cases where you can do a first principles calculus, there's many, many more cases where you can't. And and it always seems to give, as far as I know, physically reasonable answers. I mean, I think that this kind of test should not be dismissed because it's been applied to all kinds of exotic situations and so on. And I doubt that it could, if it was wrong in some subtle way, maybe, but if it was really wrong, this just wouldn't happen, okay? It would just be obvious that it was wrong. Okay, however, this is a very serious restriction, somewhat unnatural. Oh, wait, sorry, I'm not done with Ryutaki and Nagi. This region R actually is somewhat underappreciated even in the community of people who study holographic entanglement entropy, although I've been beating away at them about it. It does something for you that I think is interesting, aside from telling you the entanglement entropy. So it actually, let me first say something actually. One of the weird things about holography, about holographic dualities, is that you have these two different descriptions. One of them is a local quantum field theory on the boundary of this space, and then you have gravity in the bulk. And it's kind of obvious that there's no one-to-one map between points on the boundary and points on the bulk. So if you want to say, oh, there's a process going on, some local process on the boundary, where is the dual of that process in the bulk? It's really unclear, and vice versa. Okay, and it's certainly not any kind of one-to-one map, except maybe in very special circumstances where you sort of carefully design some process. So it's not really clear how you should, what the relation is, besides the fact that this is the boundary of this, what is the relation between these, the local physics going on in these two different spaces? And so what this region does is it associates to an arbitrary region of the boundary some region of the bulk in a very natural, geometrical, and canonical way. So every region of the boundary has associated to it a unique region of the bulk, okay? Such that the part of the boundary of R on the boundary of the spacetime is A, such that the other boundary, the one in the bulk, its area is the entanglement entropy of A. And it also has some other nice features. Maybe I'll just write them here. So this is also in that paper I just mentioned. Properties of the map are If I have, if I take the entire boundary, I get the entire bulk. If I adjoin some other region to A, so I take A union B, then it's not equal to the union of R of A and R of B, but it's R of A is contained in it, and R of B is contained in it. So in other words, it's monotone under inclusion. And if I have two different regions, then R of A, so A doesn't intersect B, then R of A doesn't intersect R of B. Okay. So these properties and this property tell me that this is somehow a fundamental part of the holographic dictionary. Although what exactly is the interpretation, what I should do with this information is not entirely clear. But I wanted to advertise this, the importance of this region. Okay. So that was Ryu Takenagi. Now, as I was saying before, this static restriction is a big restriction. There's no reason a priori when I'm defining entanglement entropy why I should restrict myself to static states. It's very interesting, actually, to calculate it, to know what it is in time-dependent states, look at various processes of thermalization or whatever, quenches and so on. And so soon after Ryu and Takenagi, there was a new formula. Presented by Rangamani, Hubini, and Takenagi. Which is covariant. So you don't have the static restriction, and now you don't have a notion of constant time slices. So since you don't have a notion of constant time slices, either or a canonical notion of constant time slices, either in the bulk or on the boundary, you can't really talk about minimal surfaces anymore. So what they did is they said, we're going to have a similar restriction, but instead of M being minimal, we're going to demand that it be extremal. So it's going to be the same formula. But now M is going to be an extremal. So extremal here means you can think of it in two different ways. Either you can think of it that it's an extremum of the area functional. See, the issue here is that if I have some surface in a Lorentzian spacetime, it has some area. If I wiggle it, if I add some small wiggles in the spatial direction, that'll increase the area. So it might be a minimal surface with respect to wiggles in the space-like direction. But if I add some wiggles going up and down in time, then that'll decrease the area. So no surface is ever a minimum or a maximum of the area. At best, it can be an extremum. So that's the restriction. Another way to say it is that the trace of the extrinsic curvature vanishes. So the trace of the extrinsic curvature is a normal vector to the surface. The normal, there's two normal directions. And so that vector should vanish. And we have the same topological restriction. So, but now we're going to add a restriction on R. And actually, it's not entirely clear whether it's necessary to put that assumption or whether if you just whether it's enough just to have a purely topological condition, and then that it'll end up necessarily being space-like, or there'll necessarily be a space-like representative. But I'm just, for the purposes of this talk, I'm just going to assume that it's space-like. Okay. So the picture. I'm not sure how well I'm going to be able to draw this, but you have some region A. And you have your M
Where's my blue chalk? You have your region M in the bulk, which is now codimension 2, and you have your R, which is codimension 1. Now, again, you should ask whether you should believe this formula. I mean, it was just a guess, okay? And it's the natural generalization of Ryu Takinagi. We really don't, if you put aside the tests that are secretly just tests of Ryu Takinagi, so if you insist on tests that are really testing the covariance, so in some time-dependent background, for example, what do we have? We have almost none of these. I mean, there's a few, but very few compared to the static case, because it's even harder to do a first principles calculation in the time-dependent case than in the static case. We don't have the general argument. We have evidence, but no proof yet, that it obeys strong subadditivity, let alone the other properties. It does seem to give reasonable answers. So I tend to think it's probably right for that reason. But my confidence is much less than for Ryu Takinagi. Okay? And it's important in particular to have new tests, and especially ones that really are about the time dependent. So that's why I'm focusing on this causality issue, which is something that simply doesn't arise in the static case. Okay? Okay, so that takes me to my third part. And before I talk about, so the short version of what I'm going to talk about in the rest of the talk, because I'm likely to run out of time, is that I want to know whether or not this formula obeys this constraint. Okay? So I need to talk a little bit about what happens holographically when you do these perturbations of the Hamiltonian. And I also just want to talk about how causality, see, there's a simpler question you can ask, forget about entanglement entropy. Obviously, a perturbation of the Hamiltonian, a local perturbation of the Hamiltonian on your space-time cannot influence, let's say, the expectation value of another local observable unless it's in the causal future of that point. So you have this causality constraint just for, let's say, expectation values of local operators. We should know whether or not holographic theories obey that constraint, which is kind of a simpler one than this entanglement entropy one, okay? So before getting to entanglement entropy, just causality and holography. So this is something obviously people ask themselves in the early days of holographic dualities. So the question is the following. If I have some point on the boundary, so I have some P, point P on the boundary, and I perturb the Hamiltonian, and let's assume, again, we're doing this time evolution to the future, so fixing the state, it's equals minus infinity, and it's represented by some bulk spacetime which solves the Einstein equation, and now I perturb the boundary Hamiltonian. So I know from a boundary quantum field theory point of view that it can't have any effect on anything outside of the causal future of P from the boundary, where now my causal future is defined with respect to the boundary metric. Okay? What does it do to the bulk? What it does to the bulk is it'll perturb, basically these operators couple to bulk fields. So I have bulk fields like the metric and a bunch of scalar fields and fermionic fields and whatever, maybe some supergravity theory or something. And these operators couple to those fields. And so if I perturb the Hamiltonian, then I'm changing my boundary conditions at some point, which means that I'll create some disturbance in the bulk that'll propagate. And since I'm assuming I'm doing forward time evolution, it'll propagate to the future. Okay, within the causal future with respect to the bulk causal structure. So I have a bulk causal structure also. And that disturbance will stay within the bulk causal future of the point P. Okay? So maybe I can
because my drawing skills don't really extend that well. So let me just take this as my boundary. So I'm just doing a slice through the boundary, and I have some point P. And from the boundary point of view, let's say Q is not in the causal future of P. But when I do this perturbation, I send a wave in through the bulk. And let's say it's a small wave, okay? But it would affect the expectation value of some local operator at Q if this signal reached it. So the question is, can this signal reach Q if P and Q are not causally related on the boundary? Okay, so are there shortcuts through the bulk? Sometimes these shortcuts would be called like warp drives. Okay, and this question was answered, as I said, in the early days of holography by Gao and Wald, who proved a GR theorem, which says the answer is no. Of course, it's a GR theorem, so there's a lot of assumptions and technical assumptions and whatever. The assumption I want to focus on here is if the bulk matter fields obey the null energy condition, which is a lot of important GR theorems assume the null energy condition, so it's quite physically reasonable. Okay, so this is good. If we didn't have this, then the whole holography story would, there'd be something sick about it. But now you see, actually, let's go back to the entanglement entropy thing and the HRT formula. So now instead of just a point Q, so I'm still going to send a signal from P through the bulk, and I'm going to ask whether or not I can change S of A. So now instead of just Q, I have a whole region A. Okay, and again, this was a slice through it. And you see, M, it's dangerous because, or at least it seems dangerous, because M sticks out from A into the bulk in a space-like direction. So M sticks out from A in a space-like direction, which seems to raise the danger that even if you can't reach A, you could reach M, change the space-time metric a little bit, and change S of A, which would violate this rule. Okay? And let me tell you something else that might also seem weird about this HRT formula, and perhaps a little bit dangerous in the time-dependent case. Not unrelated to this, which was discovered in one of the early applications of the HRT formula. So these folks, whose names I hope I spelled correctly, were applying the HRT formula to a thermalization process. So the way you represent a thermalization process holographically, you're going to have some excited state. So you put your system to an excited state, and then you watch it thermalize. So how do you put your system into an excited state? You perturb the Hamiltonian in some way, which sends in a wave of stuff, you excite one of your fields, okay? And now your bulk space-time has a lot of energy density in it, which if you've put enough in, collapses to form a black hole. And so at late times, that black hole settles down, and at late times you have a static space-time which has a black hole in it, which represents a thermal state, okay, with some entropy and so on, and all the other thermal properties. So they did that, and then in this, they wanted to know, how does the entanglement entropy of some fixed region as a function of time change, which is the kind of thing people have been doing using entanglement entropies as a probe of thermalization, okay? And they found that, so let me just draw a diagram, actually, a Penrose diagram representing this process. So we have some stuff which falls in. forms a singularity. And so now we have a horizon. And they found that this M cruised right behind the horizon and came back out. Okay. Or I should just say does. And it doesn't just go behind. So in some sense, you might say, well, this is not that surprising because horizons in GR, of course, are teleological. So, you know, I find my M in some region of space. And then later on, I dump some stuff in and a horizon forms, which comes back in backwards. Horizons kind of travel backwards in time. And this part, which was perfectly normal, is now suddenly finds itself behind an event horizon, so big deal, okay? But actually, it's a little stronger than that. It actually travels also behind apparent horizons, and those are local. Those are not teleological. And those are the regions behind which you know that there's a singularity that forms. And so what's not clear at first sight is whether this fact that the entanglement entropy depends. So we're used to the idea that if there's a horizon, as long as you are not stupid enough to jump into the horizon, none of the physics you observe or could measure depends on what's going on behind the horizon. So for example, you know, numerical relativists usually don't bother to simulate in some process where you've got a black hole forming or black hole collision. They don't bother to simulate the part of the space-time behind the horizon because if they want to extract the, let's say, the gravitational wave signal coming out, the region behind the horizon can have no effect on that, so they excise it. And now this is saying that if we believe the HRT formula, and you have your, so the case that these guys studied was like a very simple Vidya-type geometry where you can write it down analytically, but let's say you want to be more ambitious, do some maybe more interesting, more complicated process. So you ask your numerical relativity friend, you know, can you please simulate this thing, this black hole formation or black hole merger or something in anti-de Sitter space? And they say, no problem. And what observables would you like me to calculate? And you say, well, I would like you to calculate the areas of these extremal surfaces. And please calculate the areas of ones that go behind the horizon because those are important for me. You're crazy. How can the geometry of the region behind the horizon have any effect on this boundary physics? Okay, but if we believe HRT, your friend would have to go ahead and actually not excise the region behind the horizon and go ahead and simulate it up to some, and you know, which they could do at least up to some distance to the singularity. When you get close to the singularity, of course, there it becomes hard to do. And one question is, does this M actually come close to the singularity, or does it just go behind the horizon in some region where the curvatures are still perfectly small? Okay, so it's telling us that in holography, so one immediate thing it's telling us, if you believe HRT, is that the region, part of the region behind the horizon, is dual to some physics on the boundary. Okay, you can't just ignore it. You can't just pretend it's not there. You can't just erase it. Okay? But it's not entirely clear if this is a bug or a feature. You might say, well, it's crazy. HRT must be wrong. Or you might say, well, it's not that crazy because after all, nothing stops your numerical relativist friend from evolving that. And this region, although it's behind the horizon, in any case, it's determined by the state on some Cauchy slice. So it's not like there's some new secret information there that, you know, shouldn't enter into what S of A is. All the information is there. So what I want to do is make it a little more dangerous. Okay? I want to create a situation where there's a danger for HRT, where essentially this kind of thing might happen, but using this fact. Okay? So what I want is a situation where the region behind the horizon can be affected by part of the boundary. So I'm going to do that by introducing a second boundary. So I'm going to start with a two-sided eternal black hole. By the way, how am I doing on time? I'm not going to get anywhere near the end of this, so. Okay, anybody who can leave, who wants to leave, can leave. It's 2 o'clock, can I go on for 15 minutes? Is that okay? Is it okay if I go on for 15 minutes? Okay, all right. I won't take it personally if, here, I'll look this way. You can leave quickly. okay. So we have this eternal black hole. And we have these horizons in it. So the future horizon of this boundary and the future horizon of this boundary. And what this thing represents holographically is an entangled state. In fact, a thermofield double state of two non-interacting CFTs. basically, if you want an EPR pair of CFTs. Okay, when you have an EPR pair, you can't send a signal. You can't use the entanglement to send a signal from one to the other. Okay, so that means that if I have an observer, if I consider the CFT on this boundary to be like one observer or Alice, and the one on this boundary to be Bob, no change in the Hamiltonian here can affect any property of this CFT. And so obviously we have this Gowan-Wald theorem, which guarantees, and you can see it here, that a signal sent will not cross this horizon. So that's fine, and will not reach this boundary. So that's consistent. Now let's talk about entanglement entropies. And it is known in this case, because this exterior region is static, that M does not cross the horizon. Okay, so that's good. So I want to make it more dangerous. So it passed this test, but it was kind of too easy because it was static. Okay, so let me make it harder. I want a more generic situation, and I want some time dependent. So I'm going to start throwing some matter in. And I don't care where the matter could be coming out of the white hole singularity, could be coming in from the boundaries, could be going out to the boundaries. And what does my space-time look like now? The Penrose diagram gets deformed, and it gets deformed into a rectangle, which is wider than it is tall. The fact that it's wider than it is tall is a consequence of the fact that the matter I'm going to be using obeys the null energy condition plus a Gow-Wald theorem. Because if it had been too narrow, then I would have violated the Gow-Wald theorem because I could have sent a signal from one to the other. So it looks like this. And I have my horizons. And now what's happened is that the future horizon of this observer, this boundary, has separated from the past horizon of this one. And this is the boundary, the barrier of influence from points on this boundary. And I know that in this case, M extends past this horizon, but that's not really the question. That wouldn't be a problem. The question is whether or not it extends past this one. So this is, if it does, then we've got an actual contradiction. Okay. Let me make it even simpler by considering my region A to be an entire boundary. Okay? And then S of A is the amount of entanglement in this EPR pair, between these two theories. Okay, so example A equals, let's call it CFT2. Okay, the one on this boundary. So I take the whole thing. Okay. It doesn't have a, A doesn't have a boundary, so dA is empty. So there's no entangling surface. So M doesn't actually end, doesn't extend to the boundary anymore. Okay? So M is, let's say we have spherical symmetry. So M is just one of those spheres which is floating around here somewhere, unmoored from the boundary. If I'm just applying HRT. Okay, this is what happens when you apply HRT to a situation where your region doesn't have a boundary, so it doesn't have there's no entangling surface. And the area of this M, which is floating around in here somewhere, is supposed to be the amount of entanglement between CFT1 and CFT2 in whatever state is represented by this. Okay, which is time independent, even though the states are time dependent. So this is not a static situation, but the amount of entanglement is always time independent as long as you haven't done something like perturbed by something that's on both boundaries simultaneously, okay? So where is it? Where is this M whose area is the amount of entanglement? Well, I think naively, you might have guessed that, okay, there's a horizon here and a horizon here. And it's presumably the area of a horizon, so maybe, I don't know, maybe it's where they intersect or something like that. Okay, that's a possibility. So what I want to give is a causality constraint on where M can be. So clearly, by if this rule is obeyed, then M should not be anywhere in this region. Nor should it be anywhere in this region, okay? Because here it would be influenced by a perturbation in D of A going forward and here by a perturbation in D of A going backward. But similarly, it should be outside of this region and this region. And by the time I'm done, what do we have left? We have a little diamond here, which is the set of points that are not causally related to any point on the boundary. And it's very interesting, actually. I think that we're used to thinking about this. This is very commonly drawn in string theory talk or holography talks. But the generic situation, so in this case, there's really only one point, the bifurcate horizon, that is not causally connected to any point on the boundary. But generically, actually, there's a whole region. And it's kind of interesting to ask, what the heck is that region doing when it can't be accessed or seen or influenced or anything by any point on any boundary? You know, is it really part of the spacetime? Should I take it seriously? Does it actually somehow represent what the state is? So I'd like to call this region the causal shadow. And what we need for consistency of HRT we need M to be in the causal shadow. And by the way, I mean, it could be in one of the corners. So what I drew before is certainly a possibility, and one can easily construct spacetimes where it is. But it needn't be, and in many other spacetimes, it's floating around somewhere in the interior of this. Okay? So it's not true in general that M will be. But when you actually go ahead and construct examples, you find that it is indeed in somewhere inside in the causal shadow, and this constraint is obeyed. So what I would do for the rest of the talk, if I had time, is I would prove the following theorem. First of all, I mean, actually, it's a nice and not too difficult GR exercise to prove this statement. OK, essentially, let me just summarize. You take pick an M. Let's just do a proof by contradiction. Let's say it's not in the causal shadow. Send out congruences of null geodesics in all four directions. One of those four directions will hit a boundary. The expansion starts out at zero because it's an extremal surface. Use Ray-Chaudhry equation. The expansion can't become positive. But if the congruence hits the boundary, at the boundary, the area of the sphere goes to infinity. That's the contradiction. That's how you prove this. Okay. There's a so what we did is we generalized this to the general time-dependent case without spherical symmetry and so on. By the way, in that I did use the null energy condition when I applied the Ray-Chaudhry equation to say that the expansion cannot become positive. And so we proved the following theorem, and I'll end with this, which is a generalization of the statement that I just made, which is that if you do a decomposition of the bulk similar to that one, let me just draw my bulk, and I have my A, so this is a slice through the bulk, and I have my M, and I have my R, and I have R complement, which is the rest of R on some Cauchy slice in the bulk. I can decompose my bulk into four regions, as I did there. Get my yellow chalk. D of R, D of R complement, J plus of M, J minus of M. So this is a natural decomposition of the bulk. And the theorem says that if you assume the null energy condition in the bulk, then you have the following nice compatibility relation that where D of R intersects the boundary, I guess I didn't name the boundary, so I'll just write boundary. You get precisely D of A. And the same for R complement and D of A complement and J plus minus of M, J plus minus. So in other words, there is a bulk decomposition that is compatible with the boundary one in the same way that for Ryu Takinagi, I had, where'd it go? I had my R to any boundary region A, spatial region A, I have my bulk spatial region R of A. And here we have a similar space-time decomposition in the bulk, which is compatible in exactly the same way. And this theorem implies that HRT is safe. That HRT obeys this constraint. And what I also think it suggests, and this would have been my section 5, is that in some sense, it may be the case that D of R, which is itself a globally hyperbolic spacetime if we delete everything else, should be thought of as the holographic description of that reduced density matrix rho sub A. That it's the most natural, if you want to identify a part of the bulk which is identified with rho sub A, this is the most natural choice. Okay, so to summarize, we have a strong test, non-trivial test of this formula, a new one, and which I think is telling us something new about the structure of holography and the relation between the boundary and the bulk in holography. Thank you. Yes.
Some kind of small variations of your holographic area to change the surface just a little bit in the bulk, and then have some kind of local probe that would probe the bulk in a more local way by changing the surface. If you change the surface a little bit, you change only the boundary of that V of R.
Yeah.
That, with respect to A, is like a probe that is already a bit more localized in the bulk.
Yeah, that's right.
You use kind of GPS, localize
stuff very efficiently in the bulk, and do some kind of local measurements? Not in any completely obvious way, but I think somehow the data is there, that if you allow yourself enough variations of A, I mean, when you do that small variation, the change in the area, of course, I mean, maybe here, you know, you'll get a new M You know, and so it the change in the area depends on the whole geometry. But if you allow yourself enough different kinds of variations and stuff, then I can imagine, you know. Actually, it's an interesting question, which I haven't studied, but others have, of to what extent, if you're given like S of A for all possible A's, you know what the bulk geometry is. This is this reconstruction issue.
Yeah. More questions? It looks like we're using the printwise nullinergy, is that right?
Yes, not the average nullinergy.
Right, so you might worry, well, we know quantum mechanically, we don't expect that to hold.
Right, but we expect it to hold classically, so everything I was doing here was classical. Mm-hmm. And an interesting question is, what about quantum fluctuations? And those are represented by the
1 over n corrections here, which lead to quantum fluctuations here, which will not necessarily respect the null energy condition. But in addition to doing that, they will change the formula. So you have to correct the formula also. And then the question becomes, does the corrected formula still obey some theorem of this kind, where now instead of null energy condition, I have like the average null energy condition or whatever the appropriate generalization is in the presence of quantum fluctuation. So I think that's an interesting problem. I mean, it's one of these things like, you know, the area theorem for black holes uses the null energy condition. So what about quantum fluctuations and how can we generalize it to, you know, if we don't use the null energy condition, but only the average null energy condition and so on. So it's kind of a similar thing.
Let's think.